On today's episode of Higher Learning, we were joined by Gabriel Andrialo. Gabriel is a PR executive who most recently worked for Televisa Univision and has so many great opinions and insights. We had such an elevated conversation. I am so excited for you to hear it. We talked about everything from music and how it plays a role in work, to Hispanic monoculture, to Game of Thrones, and everything hiring. Gabriel is an incredible conversationalist. I cannot wait for you to hear this episode. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I'm your host, Oz Rashid, and today we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined by Gabriel Andrialo. He is a seasoned PR executive. Most recently, he was SVP of Communications at Televisa Univision. Gabriel, how are you doing?
Hey, Oz, how are you? Good.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have this conversation. We had a great pre-call. You got great energy. I'm very excited about the topics at hand. So thank you so much for being here. And I'm looking forward to getting started. So let's jump into it. You've had an incredible career. You've really been doing a ton in the media space. You've supported international markets. I'm interested. I always want to know the story. I want to know people's arc, right? How did you get involved into this space? Was this something you fell into, getting into media, getting into PR? Like, when did you realize that you had a desire to be in this space? And how did that kind of evolve as you got your career started?
That's a great question. And I love the word that you use, arc, because it is an arc, right? And it's funny because I had to make a choice, you know, when you're 17, 18, you have a choice to, you know, choose what you're going to do for the rest of your life, right? Or so they make you believe that that's, you know, the case. And I was between, you know, orchestra conductor and PR. Two very different, you know, career choices. And at that point, I said, listen, if I want a living and I want to live well, let me choose something that at least, you know, in my mind worked out to be a good opportunity PR. And, you know, and I always had this passion for, you know, storytelling. And it's a very cliche word, but it's truly that. It's really, you know, how do you tell a story? And I always was very passionate about that. And I did acting, drama, and, you know, it was a way to kind of like do that. And I said, hey, listen, why can't I just do PR? It seems that, you know, it's fun. My parents still don't understand quite well what I do, but in general terms, I made a choice. I'm happy with it. And it was always, you know, where I looked for as an answer to, you know, what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And listen, I can probably drive some synergies between orchestra conductor and public relations. You're working hard with a group of people to build a beautiful sounding output that makes people either understand or be happy with what they're listening to. I don't know. I'm trying here. Maybe I'm reaching a little bit. I do want to dive back into the music aspect because I find it fascinating that you spend so much of your life kind of focused in there. You're so passionate about it. But I'm also interested, as you look into your next steps, the next career step that you take, next company you work at, obviously you're going to want to take advantage of the expertise you've built over this time. But what are you really valuing in the next company you work at? Is the industry important? Is it the maturity, the culture of the company? Like, what are you going to be looking for as you're trying to identify that next opportunity?
So I've been thinking a lot about that question. And, you know, I always come to the same kind of conclusion, which is I want a place where culture fits right for me and I'm right for them, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, you know, this perfect match, kind of like now, you know, you have two people are trying to meet each other and, you know, they have synergies, they have things that they don't coincide. But at the end of the day, you know, it's about that relationship. It's about, you know, how you feel about the other side. And have been, you know, in the industry so long and also in other, you know, companies beyond the last one that I've been with, I feel that I value a lot how that relationship flows and the energy that it's between. And the more, you know, I think about it, the more that I'm inclined to say, hey, listen, this is me, you know, authenticity for me, it's very, very, very important. And showing who I am and the company appreciating me for what is the value that I bring to the table, it's really important. And sometimes we, you know, we underestimate that power because we generally think, oh, great, this is, you know, an incredible company to work for, or, you know, this is a massive brand, how am I going to pass on this? And, you know, trust me that if you're not in sync with the company, it will be very tough for you to work on an everyday basis there. And at the end of the day, you know, I say we love what we do, but we really need to be in love with what we do, right? And at the end of the day, if you don't have that energy flowing in between, you know, the company and you, then that becomes really, really, really hard. And I'm realizing that more than ever before in my career.
Wow, that's a great reflection on your part. It's important. We spend so much time at work, you know, loving the people that you work with, loving the challenges you're taking on, feeling you're part of a bigger purpose. I don't understand how people could go through life any other way. If you're going to put in so much time into something, do it something that you can feel good about. And that doesn't mean every day is going to be puppy dogs and lollipops, but it is about finding that fit. And really, it's kind of a running joke here at MSH. I make dating analogies all the time because, you know, it's the same thing with dating, right? Maybe I'm a great guy, maybe I'm not. But for my wife, I'm the right fit, okay? And that doesn't mean that's the universally going to be the case for everybody. But for her, it's a good match. And I'm thankful for that. Now, same thing with the company, okay? And so there's certain companies that we draw a line with at MSH that we won't work with for certain ethical reasons, right? But for the by and large, I don't look at things or companies as good and bad. I look at them as this is what they are. And there's going to be certain people that fit that, want that. And there's going to be others that don't. For example, if a company is paying, you know, really top of market, but they work their people really hard and they have a culture of, you know, the fast deadlines and heavy timelines and things like that. There's going to be a lot of people that opt out and say, that's not for me. I'm not interested, right? But there's going to be some people that gravitate towards that. They want that. They want to be compensated above market. They don't mind putting in the work. And so recruiting is ultimately about being a matchmaker and figuring out what's important to this person. What does this company actually do well? And how do we make those things mesh? And if you do a good job of that, that's how you're going to identify a lot of great people for great organizations. And that's what you're going through right now, too. You want to make sure. Now, it's like dating, because sometimes you think you know what you're getting to, but you don't in the interview process. But you're going to have to try to navigate and figure out where are the place that I'm going to fit best. Sounds like you have a pretty good idea of what that sounds like and what that looks like, though.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what you said, it's absolutely true. And, you know, I've been working with a coach for the past 6 months in trying to understand, you know, where did I want to take my career. And this process of vetting each other, that was something that I never understood before. And the more I think about it, it says like what you just said, you know, once I'm, you know, going out with somebody, I'm dating someone. And for me, that has been a long, long time ago. I've been married for 20 years. but you know, you're vetting each other. You're trying to understand where you match, where you don't. And we generally, you know, forget about the process of me vetting the company, because either we are very inclined to that brand or we love it or we think we love it, because then, you know, it's not the same what you see in the outside than what you see in the inside. So
let me give you a perfect parallel there, right? Like when we're dating, right? Hopefully you're getting that best version of that person sitting across the dinner table from you, right? Or at least that's what usually happens, hopefully. Same thing with the interview, right? Like it's this like controlled amount of time where both sides are trying to better understand what they're walking into, what they're getting into. But at the same time, both sides are also putting on, I don't want to say a show, but a lot of times they're putting on their best self. They're putting on, you know, sometimes it's smoke and mirrors. And so that's why it's really important in both situations to kind of cut through and understand what's real and what's perception or what's aspirational, right? And I think that's so key for people who are looking for work. So one of the other, and I apologize, I didn't mean to cut you off. Is there anything else you wanted to finish with there?
No.
Okay, perfect. Just want to make sure I'm being a good host. So the other thing that we talked about, and there was many things that we talked about that I'm very excited about, but one that is near and dear to my heart is how when you support Latin America, a lot of times when you're based in the U.S., there's this perception of and you said this best, U.S. Hispanic monoculture. And listen, I've said before, when I think about Europe and I think about all those different countries there, you know, somebody from France versus Italy versus Germany, so many distinct cultures, distinct languages, all these different things, right? But I remember when I lived in Southern California and Arizona and I moved to Florida, I don't think I gave enough credit to the differences and the uniqueness of all the different countries in Latin America. So I'm just interested, why do you think that perception is, number one? And then what did you learn as you traveled to these different countries and how the cultural nuance, right, was very, very, very different market to market? And you actually have to be marketing in a very different way to somebody in Chile, opposed to say somebody in maybe Central America. Tell us about why you think that perception exists and then what you've learned over your travels and time.
Wow. So that's a massive question. And it's a very, you know, it's a very incredible, important point of discussion. And I think, you know, one that I've been dealing with for the past 3 years working at Televisa Univision, and I do think they do an incredible job trying to, you know, untangle that perception. You know, it's critical that we understand that, you know, this misconception, from my point of view, and I'm going to do that disclaimer because I don't have, you know, the absolute truth, but from what I've seen, and also, you know, I'm from Hispanic origin. I'm from originally from Argentina, and I only moved to the States 15 years ago. It seems like a lot, but it's not even, you know, a lot of time. I think it's based on two or three things. The first one, I think it's the understanding that common language is a unifying factor for culture. And that it's absolutely not true. And let me go through the reasons, and then I can explain each one. The second thing I think it's, you know, underexposure and education on, you know, differences in between the different sites and different parts of the states in regards to, you know, immigration patterns, right? Because, and I'm going to stereotype just for the, you know, the sake of the argument, but if you live in California and you live in a much more Mexican-centric, you know, region of the country, you would tend to think that, you know, the predominant Hispanic culture is Mexican, right? Whereas if you fly to Miami, you're going to see that that's absolutely not necessarily the case, right? So, you know, immigration patterns had also to do with this understanding of overgeneralization of Hispanic as a monolithic, you know, culture. And the third reason, which I think it's the more intricate one, in a sense, it's the, you know, the marketing and categorization of Hispanics under just one word, right? You know, the racial understanding of Hispanic or Latino, even when we, you know, when we go into official census data or, you know, official forms and you go to the DMV or whatever, there is no, you know, difference between Hispanic from Argentina, Hispanic from Colombia, Hispanic from Honduras, just Hispanic or Latino, whatever shows up first, right? So that single demographic, you know, word creates the perception of, you know, just one culture. And even when we overgeneralize from a politics perspective, the Latino vote, well, it's not the Latino vote. I mean, the Latino vote, it's, yeah, it's the same way that I can say the white vote, but that's not accurate, right? So it's not accurate on the Hispanic side either.
So let me repeat those back to you before you give the reasons, because I want to be on the same page about that. So you're saying the fact that there's one unifying language, where in other continents there's lots of different languages separating the different countries, is plays an aspect of it. The education and understanding of immigration patterns, and you couldn't be more spot on, by the way. I grew up in Southern California and Arizona, and all of my kind of interactions were with Mexican population, right? Eating Mexican food, going to Mexico, things like that. And I moved to Miami, and my roommate at the time was Venezuelan. And so I learned a lot about his culture, what they did for Christmas, what his family grew up with, Simon Bolivar, like all these different things. I learned all about it because I got more educated. I had more exposure, and it was a big awakening for me. So I totally agree with you on that. And then if I'm hearing naming convention, right, Hispanic or Latino, how it gets grouped into one, rather where you see more nuance in other continents. Those are the three reasons you think that the monoculture exists. Okay, so explain them. Let's go from one.
So, you know, from a language perspective, yes. I mean, obviously, when you go to Europe, you're going to see Polish, Italian, Russian, German, and so on and so forth, right? So there is a different, you know, understanding from a geographical standpoint where they're coming from, because the language defines that. Now, what's interesting to me, and I use, you know, in my head, I have these acronym called genre for me to explain this in a simple way, which is, you know, geographic diversity, experiences and generational differences, nuances in language, racial diversity and acculturation. And all of those five things are somewhat, you know, what explain why Latinos are not just one, you know, culture. So geographic diversity, Latin America is comprised of over 20 countries. Okay. If I take Europe, I think it's more than, you know, 40 something, right? And I'm not contemplating within Latin America, the Caribbean, which I think personally, it's a sub-region in, you know, one that it's very distinct in its own nature and its own cultural assets. And it's not even one either, right? Because, you know, the Caribbean has also differences, and you have there, you have, you know, much more stagnant differences in language as well. So, you know, we come from different places. I come from Argentina, my neighbor comes from Colombia, and the other neighbor comes from Haiti, right? So that shows you that in a way, you know, geographical differences mark a difference in culture, because on my right side they celebrate things that I've never celebrated in Argentina. On the other side they celebrate things and they do others that I have never experienced in my life. I was never exposed to that, and it's so beautiful that we have this wide array of cultures that you know just show us, you know, how different we are around the world. And I embrace diversity in a way that for me, it's really, really important, because it brings an open-mindedness to us that it's unique in the way that we incorporate that. And yes, I was very lucky to travel through Latin America. And I used to have a boss that told me once, listen, Gabo, that's how they call me. You know, if you want to spend, you know, a couple of weekends here to talk to people and understand who they are, what they do, it's better to understand there, talking to people, seeing their customs, see what they do, what they don't like, than learning from perception, right? And if you handle Latin America, you have to go and you have to know each one of these countries, right? Or at least, you know, the predominant ones that from a marketing standpoint makes more sense. The other thing that I think is very important is experiences and generational differences. The cultural identities that we have between people that are recent immigrants or first generation, you know, Americans, the Savo kids generation, the families that have been in the United States for multiple generations, but they have, you know, Hispanic descendants. Those, we behave so different, so, so different. And we have not only consuming preferences are completely different among each other, but even you know, at a very core element of how we consume news. Not everybody consumes news the same way. And, you know, first generation immigrants, they might consume news in Spanish. Whereas, you know, somebody that has been here for a long time, they might, you know, want to choose in English because they're more, you know, assimilated to that.
Can I ask me about that? Like, do you think that consumption follows more generational lines, right, than it does regional lines a lot of the time? Like somebody, a teenager in Poland and a teenager in Argentina are probably taking in their news in similar channels, right? Opposed to, say, somebody who is 60 in Argentina versus the teenager. Fair?
Yeah, probably. I would, yeah, I mean, I am the kind of person that always says depends, right?
Depends, right?
Yeah, depends. But I would say, and I would argue that, you know, yeah, it's a generational thing. Some of the consumption behaviors are more generational.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I totally agree with you. Yeah.
Then, you know, language variations, like what I said, I don't speak the same Spanish in Argentina that they speak in Colombia. And sometimes we even make fun of words that they're the same, but mean completely different things in both countries, which it's an internal joke, I guess, in between Spanish speaking, you know, people. But, you know, the differences are sometimes are very striking, and not only from, idioms perspective, but also, you know, the words that we use on an everyday life to describe things or, you know, things that we do. So, you know, there is variations that we need to understand. The other point is, you know, racial backgrounds are so different. You know, there are countries that are more, maybe more indigenous, you know, descending or background. Some are more European ones. Some, you know, are more African, or they have African mixed, you know, racial ancestry there. So, again, background, it's very important in how we understand that. So if I take all of these elements that I said, and I'm sure I confused everyone by now, but, you know, it really defines and tells a story that an U.S. Hispanic that it's Mexican descendant is not the same as one that is Colombian, and one that has been here, Colombian, that it's, you know, been here for 20 years, not the same as one that has just gotten here. So this understanding that there's one U.S. Hispanic market, I think it's not valid as an understanding because of the cultural differences that we have. And I'm going to quote Univision on this because I think they nailed it with this, you know, slogan, which is, you know, to be able to target this market, you have to be in culture, in language. And I'm going to use a very simple example of what I live every weekend. I subscribe to Apple TV Plus MLS Pass, right? Season Pass, because I love Messi, I'm Argentinian, and I love soccer and whatnot. If you watch the Inter Miami soccer matches on Apple TV in Spanish, you're going to hear Argentinian narrators and commentators. Whereas if you watch an LAFC game, you're going to hear more Mexican accent on air. Mm. And that has to do with the way they cater to each culture in language, because it's still Spanish, but they cater to each one of the, you know, clusters of people that will be more likely to watch that game. And I think that's so well done. And so I applaud whoever thought of that from a diversity standpoint and marketing standpoint. I applaud that because it really makes a difference. I can't watch a match from Messi in a Mexican accent. I can't. It's beyond me, and it has nothing to do with the narrator. It's just the way I'm used to, you know, watching the match and enjoy it. So all of these things make, you know, the big U.S. Hispanic dilemma that we have in the U.S. as an understanding of one culture against many, and, you know, Latin America as one instead of, you know, a sum of more than 20 countries that it's comprised of.
Yeah, so much I want to respond to with here, but I want to do a couple of things. Let's first recap. So genre, G, go ahead.
G-E-N-R-A.
Okay.
So geographic diversity, experiences and generational differences, nuances in language, racial diversity and background, and acculturation and assimilation variations.
I love it. Such an elevated conversation on monoculture and immigration and cultural nuance. Love it, man. Absolutely incredible. Also a big Inter Miami fan. Suarez, I'm a big Liverpool guy, so that was one of my favorite players. Love Messi, obviously. They're at the top of the table right now, so we hope that continues. Keep their health and keep going. It's interesting you say that, though, in a very different way. I started following soccer, and you can tell because I call it soccer that I'm American, back in 2014. And what happened was I started watching the World Cup. I was watching the World Cup. I was excited about it. I was cheering for America. We had a pretty good team, relatively speaking. We played Belgium, and it was a very closely contested match. And I remember watching, like, we were very excited. We were cheering for it in the MSH office at the time. And I'm looking at all the players, and I'm seeing Kevin De Bruyne and Vincent Kompany and Eden Hazard, right? All these great players. And I just remember being like, wow, these guys are, like, really good players. This is really exciting. And I started, like, following where they all played, right? They all played in different leagues across the world. And so then I started to become a fan. So I picked Liverpool, and I started following, and I've been to Anfield now. And I'm like, obviously, this past weekend was tough with Jurgen Klopp, you know, leaving the club. But ultimately, even if I wanted to get into Real Madrid, even if I wanted to get into Barcelona, even if I wanted to get into the Bundesliga, whatever it may be, because the Premier League was native English and I could get English commentators, and that was like back in 2014, 15, 16, when we didn't have as many options as we have now, I naturally leaned in to those clubs. Whereas maybe if I had started following soccer now, because of the availability of all the different dialects and languages and things, maybe I'd be I would never say a Real Madrid guy, but maybe a Barcelona guy. Maybe I'd be Atletico, maybe something else. So I agree with you. It's funny that you having this access really matters, both from your own culture and how you interact with the sport, but also in your language, you know. And I think it's wonderful that there's so many different more opportunities to be exposed to these things globally. And I do believe that globalization is a really great, important thing, particularly in sports, particularly in these things that bring us together. So I couldn't compound on what you said. I just wanted to follow up a little bit, but love, love, love the topic. And I appreciate all the intelligence you brought to that with your take. I'm going to be remembering genre for sure. So thank you very much. I want to talk about one other thing, music. Now, most people I know love music. I love music, but few people love music or as passionate about music as you are. You mentioned that you were going to be an orchestra conductor, or that was a potential career path for you. I see kind of a piano art behind you. We talked about, I'm just interested, how does music play a part in your life and particularly in your work? I'm interested, like, when you work, does the music, do you have it in the background? Do you listen on the way to work? Like, what does music do for you in your life personally? But also, I'm interested in how you integrate it professionally.
So, allow me to answer that question by saying that it wasn't long ago that I really understood how much I borrowed from music into my life. And I say that not only because I brought so many elements to my personal essence, but also because I understand music as, you know, what keeps my soul alive, my heart strength, right? So I've studied music For a couple of years, I studied opera singing. I sang in choirs for many, 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 many years. I was very, very lucky and fortunate to be able to sing Beethoven in Teatro Colón in Buenos Aires, which is the main opera house in I would say in Latin America right now. So, you know, music was always something that wasn't, you know, a core part and a core element of who I am and representing me, and it's part of my identity and it's forged there. So obviously I borrowed and I took a lot of elements from that. I think there are two very important things that I borrow from music, which are an empathy, understanding, a nuance, an attunement, I would say, and an emotionally tenacious one. And when you tap into the energy of the heart in that way, you know, first of all, it has shown me that leadership is so much more than just, you know, providing direction or vision or making a team work. I think it's, you know, it's creating that flow of collective energy that creates that resonance from the inside out. And I was, you know, I was trying to explain this to a friend the other day, and I say, listen, think of it as, you know, I've sung in choirs my entire life. So think of it as if you're balancing individual, you know, voices to create something that it's greater than the sum of its part, right? Which is kind of like an orchestra and a choir. So harmonizing that, it's the beauty of it. Because in itself, if you listen to the parts of the tenor, or if you listen to the parts of the violin or the viola or whatever it is that you choose, you know, they're not going to sound as beautiful as the sum of all its parts. So harmonizing that in a way that creates that resonance, creates that emotional connection with whoever it's listening, I think it's incredibly beautiful. And when you take that into a work setting, into a, you know, an organization, you're doing that on a constant basis with your team. As a leader, at least, I've always, you know, envisioned that, you know, knowing when my voice needed to decrease for somebody else to show up and shine, when to create, you know, that bond and shared vulnerability among each other that creates, you know, a more tuned, you know, energy for things to go the way that that we needed to go. You know, it's almost communicating without words in a profession that I communicate with extra words, right? So that subtleness, that underscoring, that attunement to, you know, synchronicity and understanding in a team setting, that I borrowed from music at 120%. I've never learned that on, you know, on the street or on a book. I've learned that from experience, being part of something that is as beautiful and incredibly, you know, heartwarming as music. And you know, making sure that flows and that constantly, I always say, you know, we live in between consonance and dissonance, much like music, right? So we go from theme A to theme B, we progress, we, you know, we increase our loudness and, you know, we go from fortissimo to pianissimo to whatever. And, you know, work and life, I see it that way as well, right? So dissonance is those cringing moments, where consonance is those beautiful that I enjoy and love and peace and harmony. You know, but moving across all of that as if we are in a symphony, that's also, you know, work. And making sure that flows in a way that it's not blocked by anything, you know, I think that's my work of service as a leader and something that I've only learned through music and nowhere else.
So Gaba, I don't know what your talent level is as an orchestra conductor, but I got to tell you, I think you definitely picked the right choice with communications. Your ability to articulate and use these analogies is phenomenal. That was excellent. You're also an incredible storyteller. Now let's talk about bad storytelling. What a segue, right? Game of Thrones. You worked at HBO. You were there during the time, a show near and dear to my heart. We talked about it a little bit. I mean, I was as big a fan as you could be. I mean, I didn't read the books, but I got into the show season one, watched it every Sunday all the way throughout. If you had asked me every week of that entire time, best show ever, best show ever, best show ever, up there with The Wire, Breaking Bad, all these other shows that I've loved. And then even as we were going through, you know, the final season, okay, It's hard to tell if things were kind of like falling apart a little bit, that the storytelling was changing, that there were some errors made, that the way that they were kind of like deciding to kind of wrap some of these things up, the narrative and the discussion just kind of really started to be cut in favor of action and scene jumping. So a lot of was happening. But even at the time, I was like one of these guys that was like, who loves something like an ex-girlfriend, and my friends are trying to tell me she was bad news. I'm like, no, you don't get it. They're gonna land the plane. It's gonna be amazing. And then I got to the end, and I was at the end. As it turned off, I was so frustrated by the ending, and you could just tell that there were so many bad decisions made. So I just gotta ask you, as somebody who was at HBO, I'm sure you weren't sitting with Benioff and Weiss at the table and advising on any of the storytelling yourself, but just tell me a little bit about the experience behind being behind such a phenomenon while working there, but also what you think happened that last season that led to, I don't know, not a very great perception or landing of the plane.
So I'm gonna make the appropriate disclaimer to my former HBO colleagues that I'm gonna speak from my own voice. This is what I think, and you know, it has nothing to do with an official poster. But you know, I personally, regardless of where I liked the ending or I didn't like, and you know, and I remember sitting down with Dan and David when I took them to Brazil for CCXP, which is a big, you know, convention there, and asking, hey, how was the finale? And they couldn't tell me anything, of course, but, you know, they said, you're going to be surprised and you're going to be, you know, excited to watch how it progressed everything. I would have to say and argue that the finale accomplished what it was supposed to do. And let me put that into perspective, which is definitely a polarizing finale, right? So either you loved it or you hated it. There's no in between. There's no gray zone here. You loved it or you hate it. But let me tell you something. There is nobody right now that you would ask what happened with Game of Thrones that they wouldn't be able to tell you, I hate it or I liked it, right? So it really accomplished to create a moment in pop culture that it was never achieved before. And we're talking about, you know, a show that in itself, it moved masses and people, you know, tune it in, they pirate it in, they watch it everywhere. I remember being very cautious about the handling of the materials for pre-shows and stuff like that. And, you know, everybody was so excited. So it accomplished to be part of a very conversational, you know, ending of a story that actually made you, oh, I cannot know what happened. Like, I need to watch this. So when you put it into perspective, from a marketing perspective, it knocked it out of the park. From a business perspective, it knocked it out of the park because it brought a lot of, you know, subscriptions to HBO. And at that point, it was HBO Go and so on and so forth. So, and from a narrative perspective, you know, you might not like it or love it. I personally, and I'm going to say this and I'm going to, you know, jump into the water here, it's I didn't like it because I was expecting a different finale, but it's a my expectation. And, you know, and I'm no showrunner, but I can tell you as a showrunner, it's so hard to give an ending to such a hype show. And let's not forget that Damon Lindelof did the same thing with Lost, you know, a few years before that. What was his name? Craig Thomas, I think, was one of the creators of I Met Your Mother, that also didn't have, you know, a finale that everybody loved or enjoyed. So it's so hard when you have such a hype, you know, show to end on a good note, because you're always going to disappoint some part of the fandom, and especially when it's so, you know, you're so passionate about it. I think that's one of the unique things that Game of Thrones created, to be a passionate show. And as cruel and as gritty and, you know, as dark as that show might have been for many, many seasons, people really were so into it that today we have, you know, girls named Arya, people named Jon Snow, right? So
my daughter's named Arya. Really,
right. So it defined a generation. So judging a show by its finale, I think it will be very underestimating on an over, you know, overly proportionate way. But again, I personally didn't like it, but I see how it accomplished everything that it was supposed to do.
Okay, I'm getting my gloves off. I'm ready, because now I've got to push back. Okay, so here we go. First off, what I would say is you're absolutely right. It's incredibly hard to end a show that's as popular as that. You're always going to leave people wanting more. People aren't going to be happy it's leaving. They're not going to like all the decisions. I totally get that. I look at Sopranos. I look at Lost. I look at How I Met Your Mother. Like, oh, to your point, Seinfeld got ridiculed for its, right? And those were not great endings by any stretch of the imagination. Now, I will say that the shows that have landed the plane well at the end, right, like a Breaking Bad, kept the consistency and the themes of the stories that they were trying to tell you the entire time. And you walked away from it, even if you didn't like the choices they made, saying, that makes sense. I get it. Here was the problem. So I agree with you in terms of marketing, subscriptions, everything. Game of Thrones killed it. But I would be the believer that it was the seasons leading up to the final season. And I will tell you, I'll go through and I will tell you what I think are the main errors that they made and that they needed to do differently. So the first one is there was just some casualness and errors of like a Starbucks cup and a water bottle that you saw on the shows and that they had all over Twitter after the fact, that a show of that much money and that much focus and that much detail, editing's got to catch that. So that's a small little thing, but it's also kind of a sign of worse things to come, right? Then we have the fact that they had that episode where it was the seminal episode where they're fighting the Night King. I didn't love how they took that and how they ended that, but that episode was so dark and so hard to kind of pay attention to what was going on that was a little bit frustrating. So that was a very curious decision. The L plus R equals J, I think, is how the story went. That was such a big reveal the season before, and yet it almost was like it was inconsequential. It didn't matter in the final season. And then the things that bothered me the most were, by far, Cersei Lannister is one of the greatest villains of all time, and you're expecting her to get like this big comeuppance, and then boom, a rock just falls on her, right? And then we've got Bran, who I actually was cheering for him at the beginning and wanting him to be the king season 1, 2, 3, but then he went away for a long time, and then the way that they gave him the he knows how to tell stories and all that, I was just like, what is going on here? So to me, what happened was it was a lot of money, right? We know that. Every episode was like the breaking records in terms of the cost. You could tell that everybody had like the fame and the attention had worn everybody out. They were ready for it to be done. And so it felt like they really tried to take a show that had really built itself on conversations and narrative, right? Condense it, pack in a bunch into that last season, cut the episodes, and then get away from what made it beautiful. They could have gone in a lot of different directions with what ended up being, and then Jon Snow getting sent to the wall was extremely unsatisfying as well. Sorry, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen Game of Thrones, but if you haven't seen it by now, that's on you. So, and then Daenerys dying, I mean, again, that's another thing that we can debate. But anyway, my point is more the execution and thought of what had happened the seasons before, I thought could have been more well done. And believe me, here's my biggest problem with it, and why I know it's an issue. I want to be that guy whose daughter is named Arya. You brought that up. You didn't even know that about me. My daughter is named Arya, in part because of how much I enjoyed the show. But when I want to talk about the best TV shows of all time, which is a stupid conversation you get into over beers or whatever it may be, I can't even bring up Game of Thrones because everybody's got the trump card on me and is like, yeah, they didn't end it properly. Yeah, but I'm like, well, the first season's... So anyway, that's me. I'm passionate about it. It's something that I wish they would have done differently. Here's what I'd ask them to do. Can we consider how much money you'd make if you went and redid that season and just made a couple creative choices? I mean, all the other actors can come back now. We can make it work. Nobody's too big. Right? Is there who came out of that show that became too big to not go back? Nobody. You can make the Mila Clark. She's back. We're making it happen. So anyway, you have friends at HBO. Bring it up to them. Let them know. We don't have to take any credit for the idea, but that's going to make a ton of money for them. What do you think?
For sure. For sure. No, and let me tell you, as a fan, I empathize with you on some of those points. I would have personally enjoyed, you know, being able to, you know, see a different pace for the ending. But I understand, you know, there's artistic decisions and those sort of things that are, you know, beyond my control. And I think, you know, I chose, beyond loving the job, my job at that point, and being able to promote that and going, you know, to premieres and so on and so forth, you know, you do all those sort of things. But, you know, I think from a fan perspective, I also see the show and I said, listen, I may have not enjoyed the ending as I was expecting to, but I look at everything and I say, this is such a well done show. It has so many elements. So it could take, you know, a certain percentage of being one of the greatest shows on TV, but nobody can deny that even though you might not have, you know, enjoyed the finale, Lost was one of the greatest shows of all time. You know, Game of Thrones was one, Seinfeld was another. So when you look at the whole complete, you know, run of seasons, you say, well, yeah, I mean, I have enjoyed the finale, but I enjoy the other 6 years that I've been watching the show.
I'm totally with you. It's a phenomenon unlike I've seen otherwise in TV, for sure. If only why I wanted to have more justice as it's remembered, right? But I'm with you. You're right.
Here, I'll pass on your idea.
Okay, pass on my idea. All right, listen. So we've talked stereotypes in culture in Latin America. We've talked music in work, and we've talked prestige TV. Did you know this was a hiring podcast? I kind of forgot myself. So let's dive into that. Gabe, you've done a lot of hiring throughout your career. So I want to start here and I want to ask you, what's a core hiring philosophy you have for anybody that you want to bring onto your team?
Potential. And it's very interesting, the balance act that you need to do between what you need now and what you need for the future, right? So my philosophy, I think, it's looking for candidates that, you know, have the potential to learn and grow in that setting, right? And towards, you know, where I want to take them, because later on it's going to be easier to accommodate them in that way. But if they don't have that potential to grow and it only, you know, do what I need them now, then that's very, very hard.
Yeah. And the key to that is understanding the environment that you're in, what your company's environment is going to be in the next year, 2 years, and then getting out in front of that and being predictive there, and then finding people that can match both now and the go forward. Do you have questions that you like to ask to kind of determine somebody's potential? Like, any come to mind when I say that?
I would say, you know, the one question that I always ask, and it has to do with, you know, with the potential, because it shows me how they think. It's what's your biggest failure and why? Because with that question, I'm looking for vulnerability. So it's kind of like, how open are you to express, you know, where you fail? Because that also tells me, you know, if you're open to learn. Because at the end of the day, for me, you learn more from failing. And I'm not shy of saying, you know, that we make mistakes because we're human beings, right? And you're never going to be infallible. So if you show me that you've made a mistake, then you also show me that you can learn from it, right? And then you show me the kind of mindset that you have, big picture, small picture. Oh, I messed up with an email that I sent, or, you know, I decided my career path was a different thing and, you know, I chose different. So it really gives me a glimpse of where you're at in terms of mindset and mindness and you know, so I think that shows me how much learning potential they have. And again, you know, once you put it into the context, which is, I couldn't agree more with you there, if it plays out or not, because that's the other thing. You might find people that are great, but they're not a fit. And they have the growth potential, they have the learning mindset, they have, you know, everything that you need, but they're not a great fit in the environment that you are at.
That's the key. You got to find that right fit. Memorable interview experiences, bad ones, good ones. You were interviewing somebody else. When I ask you about that, what comes to mind?
So memorable ones, one bad, one really good. Really good, two jobs ago. you know, it was such a great conversation. It felt like, you know, an empathic checking with each other and say, hey, I'm giving you this, you're giving me that. How does it play out? Do you like it? Very transparent, very humane, very, you know, it felt that we were talking and sinking in. And that person, she embodied the company culture. So he was a great ambassador of it. And you could tell. And I said, listen, I love what you do. I love the passion that you're bringing to the table. I love that you're not question answer dynamic, but you're actually interesting and listening and, you know, and reacting to what I'm saying, regardless of, you know, of everything else. And you're understanding where I'm coming from and you're seeing how adept I'm for that job without asking me the question, tell me your three strengths or tell me, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, memorable was that one.
Was that the manager of the job that you would have been working for? Or was that somebody on the team or?
No, it was a recruiter. It was a recruiter. And I usually don't find, yes, and I usually don't find that level of, you know, attunement in, you know, first, second, third screenings from HR people. And she was awesome. And she reached out to me this week and I was like, Hey, Annie, she was great.
You gotta be careful, Gabo, because I'm always asking people to introduce me to the most talented people they know so I can hire them. So I got
I'll
one
introduce
name there.
I'll introduce you to you.
We're gonna have to do some reconnaissance there, Jackie. We might have to look at. All right, give me the bad one. The bad ones are always fun. What? Tell me the bad interview.
Bad one. I think it was a complete opposite. Do you know when you go into those, you know, settings and you say, oh, this is just, you know, checking a box. They were not paying attention to me. They were not listening. They were making questions. I would have said, I would have said, I hate, you know, Game of Thrones, and nobody would have reacted to anything. And the next question would have come to me and asked me, what are your three strengths? And it was such, you know, discouraging. And the minute that that happened, the minute that I realized that I was in that setting, I said, the job is really interesting, but I really don't want to work for you, regardless if you offer me this position or not. I didn't end up having it whatsoever, but you know, that interview where nobody, it's really making sure that it's listening and there's, you know, that rapport with each other and what we said before, you know, we're knowing each other. We're to, let's make an effort of, you know, understanding here. And it was absolutely, it was not there. Let's put it that way. It was definitely not there. And that wasn't so long ago in my career.
The opposite of a great candidate experience. Well, needless to say, that doesn't sound like an opportunity that you would have taken on or enjoyed. So sometimes it's good that people self-select out like that and show who they are and what the culture of their company is. I think it's so reflective of what you would get in the job, at least at some level. What about when you miss? Because we've all made bad hires before. That's just, you know, part of the cost of being a leader, right? When you miss on somebody, is there a theme that you can look back on or a regret that you might have that's common?
Absolutely, yes. And well, I mean, I was very fortunate not to experience many of this. but I think, you know, the times that happened to me, they were basically because of two reasons. The first one is I was applying a short-term vision into the selection. So I was not following my own philosophy. I have to accept that. So I was choosing for the role instead of choosing for what's better for the team and, you know, the organization and everything else. And then I think I was, you know, culturally biased by the organization. And this goes back to what you said before, right? You know, everybody in the company hires similarly, right? Because the culture of the company pushes you to select people that are shaped in a certain way or that they show certain traits or those sort of things. And I think that when I selected that person, I was thinking, you know, what do I need now to solve a problem now instead of, you know, what is it that the culture needs to where I want to take it? And what is it that is going to be, you know, somebody that can help me shape up that culture moving forward? But, you know, company-wise, I think it was instilling me that I need to look for certain things. So I centered on that and pushed forward. And I said, and then I realized I made a mistake here.
Yeah. I'm not remembering which guest, but it's one of our Wise former podcast guests. They said that instead of looking for a cultural fit, you're looking for a cultural ad. And I really believe that distinction is very important. And it's how you get away from monoculture, homogeny, hiring people that think and act and operate like you, and instead trying to add to create that beautiful music. Because I'm going to butcher this because I'm not a big music guy, but if it's like you only had altos, right, in your symphony, you're not going to have a great range of what you can do. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I mean, yes. Technically, you know, yes. but, you know, you're so right with that. Because I strongly believe that complementarity and diversity is what makes us strong, right? So if I choose people that are similar, then I'm only doubling down on one kind of strength instead of, and most likely on the same weakness. So nobody can help each other. Nobody can be symbiotic in their relationship with another just to, you know, push through and help us grow and help us achieve the results we want. So, you know, when we look at the team composition, we need to look to that diversity of perspectives, backgrounds, strengths, mindsets, and so on and so forth. And you're so right with that. And I miss the mark on that point. But again, you know, sometimes you're just so embedded into the day-to-day stuff that it's very hard to get yourself out of it and realize you're making a mistake.
Gabriel's just being nice to me. So I appreciate that. That's very nice of you. You're making the host look good. That's what I'm trying to do for you. So We've got some simpatico going there. All right, brother. When I ask you about the best hire you've ever made, who or what comes to mind?
Best hire. Wow. It was some time ago, and I think I don't have a one best hire. I think that there was a point in my career when I was in an agency that I made a couple of good hires, and that made so much difference because of what we were saying before, the complementarity. I remember, you know, choosing two or three very different people, but they were, when you looked at them, they were so complementary to each other that you said, this is a dream team. This is just a dream team. There's no, you know, it was perfectly balanced and harmonized in many ways that I said, wow, again, different strengths, different backgrounds, different perspectives, diversity. It's, you know, it was great. It was really good. And that was at the agency that I was before HBO. And that was a great team that I
took. It's a great feeling when you get it right. And it can just alleviate so much headspace and work, and productivity goes through the roof. And it's a great feeling. That's why I spend my life doing it, trying to help companies and people find those matches. Because when you do it right, it can have tremendous impact. All right, let's go in a little bit of a different direction. So, you know, I typically ask, what are you working on that you're juiced right now? But as you're kind of transitioning and looking for that next opportunity, I'm interested. You've obviously got to have a little bit more free time right now. What are you spending your time doing? What's getting you up in the morning you're excited about that you love? Is there a hobby that you've gotten back into? Are you reading a little bit more? Are you spending time with family?
Well, I mean, I'm spending a lot more time with the family, which I really, really, really needed. Last year was very tough on travel, and that took away a lot of, you know, family moments, and I'm still catching up to that. And, you know, I think that what I'm also enjoying a lot is reuniting and reestablishing connections with people that I haven't seen in a long time, or, you know, I haven't connected in a long time, because connections are so vital. And I just wrote a post on my LinkedIn, not self-promoting myself here, but like, I'm talking about that, about connections, and, you know, how those are the things that you take away when you get out of a job. You know, those people that really created an impact, and that you created an impact on them, and reconnecting with some of those folks during the last couple of months have been really, really heartwarming for me, and something that I'm enjoying. But I'm also going back to listening to more music. I want to start, you know, restart composing and arranging some stuff. So, you know, it's going back to some of the elements within myself that I've lost through, you know, the last couple of years.
I love that. I love that reflection. When we get so caught up in our day to day and the things that we got to get done, we don't take enough time to rebuild those bridges and learn from people that have meant a lot to us, or even have those conversations. So I think that's a wonderful thing. What about some favorite content or a favorite book that maybe you've read that you want to recommend for our listeners?
That's the toughest question of all, because I'm an avid consumer of content, but let me recommend a show that I just finished watching. Not for everybody, I'm gonna say that. I'm a fan of Scandi Noir. Do you know what Scandi Noir is, Oz?
Mm-mm. No.
Scandi Noir is Scandinavian thriller with a dark twist, that's noir. And it has its unique characteristics. It's a subgenre of thrillers and, you know, whodunit type of mysteries. And I finished watching this Swedish-Danish show called The Bridge, or Brun, I think it's the pronunciation. And it's, if you're looking for a gritty, you know, cat and mouse type of thriller, you know, you're going to love this show. And performances from the town, it's superb. Quality production values are, you know, so high. I love European TV, and I love European, you know, content. And this one you can watch on a niche streaming platform that I recently discovered called MHZ. That it has a huge catalog of European content, and they specialize also on Scandi Noir type of things. And this is, you know, it starts with, you know, a crime in the bridge that connects Sweden with Denmark. And from there, you go into a serial killer scenery. But beyond that, you see the arcs of the characters. You see the subtext of how they're struggling with things, their life, the way that they go about things, their mindsets. And, you know, you spend so much time on the characters as well as the actually who did the crime, that it creates such a, you know, dark but yet interesting atmosphere. And for somebody that enjoys that kind of, you know, setting and being hooked onto the TV to see what happened next, this show is definitely one that you must watch.
What a niche take. I mean, MHZ, I never even heard of this. I should have known that this guy wasn't going to recommend like Tom Brady's Roast or Young Sheldon. You came in heavy there. Those are fine shows, but I should have known you were going to go more elevated, artistic there. There's probably one person listening to this who's like, I love that show. I love that show. And for that one listener, I'm excited for you that we just got to talk about it. That's amazing. All right, last question, Gabe. I want to know, if you had to give one bit of advice to your younger self that you didn't know then, but you know now, what would it be?
Wow. I think what it's meant for you won't pass you. And that is a phrase that my coach told me a few weeks back. And everything clicked in my head for that. And it means, you know, trust the process. Don't get anxious over things that are not, you know, meant for you. And it's really hard, you know, discerning those because you just can't. But, you know, what's truly meant for you and where you are going to be, you're definitely going to be. Either you call it universe, God, whatever you want to call it, life will put you in that place. And once you take that in and you let it sink and you think about it, you said, yes, I am where I needed to be for whatever reason it is. And now I'm growing even more than before. I'm taking time to reconnect with my family. You know, whatever is it that you're looking at from the lens that you're looking at, just enjoy that and know that you need to be where you are right now. So
I love that. Honor the process. It'll be what it's meant to be. I really like that. Gabriel, I've had such a good time on this conversation. I've learned a lot, had a few laughs. I appreciate you coming on. I'm looking forward to staying connected. Thank you so much for coming on Higher Learning.
Thank you, Oz. Take care.
Talk to you. Bye.